Seventh principle is called detaching from the outcome. The affirmation for this principle is, I trust in the universal intelligence that created me to bring my desires to me in just the right way at the perfect time. Previously, I talked a great deal about trust and about this knowing and about shifting your perceptions out of this idea that somehow you are separate from the divine intelligence that is universal. The obvious thing to remember about a universal intelligence is that if it's universal, it is in all places. Therefore, it is in all that you want and all that you are. And so manifesting is the ability to realign your intention with that divine intelligence and know that it will show up. But one of the things that we have a tendency to do as individuals is to become impatient. Our ego says to us, I want what I want, and I want it now. And we have a tendency to try to tell the universal intelligence, or to tell God, or the metaphor that I used earlier, as God is like the ocean, and we are like a glass. And so we are really a glass of God, if you will. We are a piece of God. But when you separate yourself, one little drop of water separated from the ocean alone literally can't make anything happen, is very weak and so on. And it is only when you unite yourself with that ocean, when that drop of water becomes united with the ocean, it can do anything. It is part of the universal. When you unite yourself with this divine intelligence instead of separating yourself from it, then you know that this ocean will provide. It will provide for you in precisely the right way that it is supposed to, and in exactly the right time. There's a wonderful poet that I have quoted in this program several times, and I want to quote him again. His name is Rumi. Well, Rumi wrote back in the early part of the 13th century. His poetry is still quoted today, and it's something that I would recommend you look at. Jalaluddin Rumi. And he had a poem that is called The Servant Who Loved His Prayers. And I'd like to share that with you as I talk about this idea of detaching from the outcome and letting go of your need to make something happen as you demand it to happen. It's called The Servant Who Loved His Prayers. At dawn, a certain rich man wanted to go to the steam bath. He woke his servant, Sunkwar. Ho, get moving. Get the basin and the towels and the clay for washing, and let's go to the bath. Sunkwar immediately collected what was needed, and they set out side by side along the road. As they passed the mosque, the call to prayer sounded. Sunkwar loved his five times prayer. Please, Master, rest on this bench for a while, that I may recite Surah 98, which begins, You who treat your slave with kindness. The master sat on the bench outside while Sunkwar went in. When prayers were over and the priest and all the worshippers had left, still Sunkwar remained inside. The master waited and waited. Finally, he yelled into the mosque, Sunkwar, why don't you come out? I can't. This clever one won't let me out. Have a little more patience. I hear you out there. Seven times the master waited and then shouted. Sunkwar's reply was always the same. Not yet. He won't let me come out yet. But there's no one in there but you. Everyone else is left. Who makes you sit still so long? The one who keeps me in here is the one who keeps you out there. The same who will not let you in will not let me out. The ocean will not allow its fish out of itself, nor does it let land animals in where the subtle and delicate fish move. The land creatures lumber along on the ground. No cleverness can change this. There's only one opener for the lock of these matters. Forget your figuring. Forget yourself. Listen to your friend. When you become totally obedient to that one, you'll be free. Rumi. And this idea of knowing that that divine intelligence will work in exactly the order and the preference and the time that it is supposed to. In the Course in Miracles, there's this often quoted passage that says, infinite patience produces immediate results. And it sounds like it's a contradiction, doesn't it? It sounds like a paradox. If I'm patient, infinitely patient, then I will have to wait a very long time. You know, I talked earlier about these tomato seeds that we used to plant and how the essence of tomato-ness was in every aspect of that tomato, and yet that very essence was something that isn't in the physical world at all. The cause of tomato, as we discover and we look at those seeds and we look at the dust that's in the seeds and then we try to find out what's in the dust, and ultimately we find out that there's just an energy in there. There's just a wave. There's something that's invisible to the naked eye. There's something that doesn't even exist in a physical world. There are no particles at all. You see, when you're a child, you think like a child, as it says in Corinthians 13. And I can remember as a child when those tomato shoots surfaced above the ground sometime in June, back there in Mount Clemens, and they would come up about 4 or 5 inches above the ground. I remember one time getting down there and looking at those tomato shoots and trying to hurry them along. And I got down on my knees and I started tugging at them as a little boy, maybe 3 or 4 years old. And I remember Mrs. Scarf saying, "No, no, no, you can't do that." And I was like trying to hurry it along. And this idea of attempting to hurry along the divine intelligence is something that we do with our egos all the time. Obviously, creation reveals its secrets by and by. By and by. As it is supposed to, as it is ordained. And when you get down there and start tugging at those shoots, and I remember pulling at one, and I pulled one just a little bit too hard because they're still not firmly entrenched. They don't have very long roots, tomato plants. You can pull them out with hardly any effort at all. And I pulled one right out into my hand, and that was the end of that tomato. There was no possibility because I was attempting to do something that interferes. This principle of detaching ourselves from outcome, along with having infinite patience, is really essential to your manifestation process. It is inconsistent with what we have a tendency to think is the way things should be working. Because if I do everything that I'm supposed to, if I follow all of these principles and I set down all of the rules and I get it all organized, then I expect that I'll have results. That's the time in our lives that I referred to earlier in the very first principle of being the warrior, going from the athlete to the warrior. That's the time in our lives when we set our goals. And there's nothing wrong with setting goals. I've written about it and talked about it on many programs right here at Nightingale Comet and in many of my books. But the idea of thinking that setting goals and then just going about and having them show up is still the thinking that keeps us sort of stuck back at the warrior phase of our development. It inhibits us from moving to higher places. Higher places wherein we can begin to manage the coincidences of our lives, which sounds like a contradiction, doesn't it? If it's a coincidence, you can't manage it. If you're managing it, then it's not a coincidence. But when you begin to transcend some of these paradoxes, when you reach a higher level. So setting goals is one thing, and it's something that we do at the in the earlier stages of our spiritual development. And we continue to do it. And these stages that I talked about earlier are not things that we go into and then never go back to. We go back, we come out of it, we go back. We're always moving in and out of these stages. The question is, what is my primary emphasis? Is my primary emphasis not only on setting goals, but in falling in love with those goals, and then insisting that those goals show up when I want them to show up? That is inconsistent with manifestation and with spirituality and higher consciousness. What you have to do is have your goals, which is what a tomato seed is. It's really a goal for tomatoes. But you have to then relax and turn your thoughts and your ideas and your consciousness and your awareness to your own purpose and know in your heart that it will manifest. You see, the key to relaxing about what it is that you would like to see manifested is the certainty of the outcome. If you have a certainty, as it says in the Course in Miracles, if you have a certainty of the outcome, patience is easy. If you are uncertain of the outcome, if you're not sure how it's going to work out, or if things are going to fall into place the way you would like them to, if you have that uncertainty, then you will not be able to be patient. So patience, infinite patience, is really like a trusting in God. And when you trust in God, you're trusting in the wisdom that created you. And when you trust in the wisdom that created you, you're trusting in yourself as well. Because you can never be separate from that wisdom. So patience and trust and awareness and higher consciousness are absolutely essential. And when you go to that place, when you do the meditation, and when you make what we call conscious contact with your higher self and with God, when you make that conscious contact, you shift from a belief in God or a knowing about God to knowing God. There's a very big difference between knowing about God and knowing God. Knowing about God is a belief. Knowing God is conscious contact. It's direct inner knowing. And so you make this inner contact and you have a certainty about what it is that you want to manifest. And that desire that you have is consistent with all nine of these principles. That it is based on unconditional love, and it's based on the power of attraction, and it's based on your higher awareness, and it's based on generosity and service and kindness. And then you are absolutely certain. And then you're able to detach because you're not really concerned about how it's going to show up. You see, your job in this whole business of manifesting, your job is not to say how and when. Your job is to say yes. Just yes. And then you let the how and the when take over. Now, when I say this, I know immediately what the ego part of us starts to think. I want it now, but I have to have it this way. But if I don't get it pretty soon, then I'm going to go broke. And then if this doesn't show up over here, then I'm going to have to go on welfare. And if I have to go on welfare, then and your mind starts playing all of these games about how terrible things are going to be if the person that you want to manifest doesn't show up the way you want him to show up, or if the child that you expect to have isn't showing up on time, or if the finances, or if the job, or whatever. And there's this push and this anxiety and this stress, which is based on fear and based on distrust. But you know, when you have this knowing, as it says in the Course, when you have this certainty, great things have no fear of time. You see, the universal intelligence doesn't operate in the parameters of time. Time is just our way of carving up the oneness. I was reading a story of Einstein as a young boy. And one of the things it said about young Einstein is that when he was a little boy, he picked up a compass. And when he picked up this compass, he noticed that there was something that would move the needle. But he couldn't find anything in the compass that was moving the needle. And he was intrigued by what it was that would move the needle. And he would go and turn in a certain way. He'd make a 90-degree turn, and the needle would turn and face whatever direction it was that he was facing. And yet, he hadn't done anything. And he was intrigued by what this force was inside or outside or what it was that allowed this. What would make this needle move? That force, that universal intelligence, that thing that is nameless, that thing that we can't identify in the physical world, is the provider of all of the things that will manifest to you in the physical world. And it is also the source of your life. So that when you have an alignment with that force, what happens is you get very, very peaceful. And when you get peaceful, you stop insisting. You just know. You just know that it's going to show up. And you're not demanding. You're not looking under the leaves for it. You're not asking for any favors. In fact, you understand that this universal force cannot provide special favors because it is everywhere. And if it were just for you and not for someone else, that would immediately make it not a universal force. It would be now someplace that it isn't. There's no favoritism in this. There's just this positive, absolute, unconditionally loving, knowing force in the universe that holds everything together that you come to honor, to respect, to know. And you know, it's really like, it's like changing around your perspective in life. It's like walking a new path. I've always loved this. I've read it many, many times in my talks. It's a little story by a woman named Portia Nelson. And she was asked, as a group of people were asked, in a seminar, to write down her autobiography. But they said, you only have one page. And you have to write your autobiography in 5 short chapters on one page. The autobiography of your life. That was the assignment. So Portia Nelson wrote her autobiography of her life in 5 short chapters. And this is what she said. Chapter 1. I walk down the street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I am lost. I am helpless. It isn't my fault. It takes forever to find a way out. Chapter 2. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place. But it isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. Chapter 3. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it there. I still fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out immediately. Chapter 4. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. Chapter 5. I walk down another street. The story of her life. And it's really the story of higher consciousness, and it's the story of manifesting. Being able to manifest your heart's desire, to align yourself and your intentions with this divine organizing intelligence that is limitless, that is inexhaustible, that is ever expanding, that is abundant, that is all providing and all knowing and everywhere at the same time is like walking down another street. To align yourself with that and to know that that alignment in itself is enough to bring whatever it is that has particularized, that has individualized into the world that you would like to have show up in your life and align with the particularization of that divine intelligence that is you. That it's just bringing it all together. It's just a realignment. And it will cooperate with you. The thing that will keep it from working for you is any obstacle to that flow. As I talked about when I was speaking about unconditional love, the minute that you put hatred, anger, bitterness, tension, anxiety, stress in the way of that intelligence, between you and that intelligence, you block that flow. It is a flowing. That's why we use water as a symbol of it, because it flows at all times. It's like 70% of who you are is water. 70% of this planet is water. 85% of your brain is water. It is the kahunas always use the reference of the symbol of water. Water and the universal God force are the same. That's why you need lots of it in your system at all times as an antidote to any of the things that interfere with your perfection, with your clarity, with your being at one. And so as you process and try to get a hold of this concept of water, try to imagine you're sitting by a stream and you reach into the stream and you want to get a hold of some of the water. And you reach in and you grab it real hard. And you're as tight as you can get it, and you try to hang on to it. Then you open up your hand to see what you got, and you got nothing. Because you can't get a hold of it. You can't grab it. You can't be firm with it. In order to enjoy the water and to experience the water, to know the water, you put your hand in it and you relax. And then you get to experience and know the water. The minute that you tighten and grab and insist and try to take it, it flows past you. Well, that's the same thing that happens when you are attempting to rush the universe. It's called don't push the river. You don't push it, you flow with it. You row your boat gently down the stream. Down the stream, not up the stream. You don't fight it. Merrily, merrily, always merrily. And when you grasp that, it's like walking down another street. Now, one of the keys to being able to walk down this street is that you don't have to convince anybody else who is still stuck back there in the tribal awareness, in the tribal consciousness, that indeed this is what will happen and this is what I'm doing. Because the minute you do that, you, again, put a blockage. You're always trying to keep yourself from erecting obstacles and barriers to what it is that you would like to see manifested in your life. And most of us don't realize that the obstacles that we place in front of us are the things that, they're not like bricks, and they're not boards. They're not physical apparatuses. What they are thoughts, ideas, attitudes, consciousness. And the attitude, the consciousness, the awareness of, I want this to happen, I want it to happen now. And if it doesn't happen, then I am going to blame somebody else for it. Or anger or hatred or bitterness or any of those kinds of things. Any of those attitudes immediately block the flow of the God force into your life. When I first met Guruji, this great divine being who sent me this tape and asked me to teach this manifesting meditation, the first day I met him was in California, and he had flown out from California, and I was giving a talk, and that evening a group of people had him at their home, and they had attended my lecture that day in Santa Monica, and then that evening I was to meet Guruji after he had sent me this tape, and I had agreed to do it, but it had all been done through the mail. And I was now going to meet this person who had taught me this manifesting thing, who was having needle-nose pliers showing up in my driveway, and my friends getting rich in Las Vegas. And I haven't even gone into so many of the other manifestations that began to show up including Kay O'Bara and all of these kinds. All of these were a result of this this sort of new attitude. And I went to his home that evening, and he was in another room, and there were about 60 people there who were going to listen to him speak that evening, and then I was going to speak afterwards, and we were going to speak together. But he had asked to have a private audience with me. And they ushered me into this room, and I walked in, and I felt that energy again, that real, peaceful, loving. It's like having a warm shower running inside of you. They call it the Kundalini, this energy that just seems to flow up and down your spine, that really good feeling you get, you know, like they call it getting goosebumps or whatever, that real peaceful, loving kind of feel. And you know it's coming from something other than just the physical environment, that there is an energy in there. And he looked at me, and we sat down, and we were sitting facing each other on a couple of comfortable chairs. He had this long, flowing gray beard, and we didn't speak. Now, this is without exaggeration. We didn't speak for 1 hour. We just sat in the room, and neither one of us spoke to each other for 1 hour. We just looked at each other without blinking, just in each other's eyes. And after about an hour had passed, I noticed a tear coming down his eye, out of his eye, rather, and down his face. And the same thing happened to me simultaneously. And that was our meeting, and that was our communication. And then we spoke to each other. The first thing he said to me was, "Do you have any questions about what you are doing?" And I said, "They've all been answered." And that was the extent of our conversation. I knew what I was there for. I was sent, he was sent to me, and his background of where he has come from in India and all of the teachings that he has had, my background of where I come from and growing up in the Midwest of the United States, and all of my experiences had led us both to this place. And I knew that I was to go out and to teach this manifesting meditation, which he had encouraged me to do. And I dedicated the book to him by just saying, "Thanking you for encouraging me to examine this area of manifestation from a different perspective, from the perspective of having walked down a new street, one that didn't keep me back there in those old habits. Those old habits of pushing and demanding and insisting. When you have this patience, this infinite patience, and when you're able to detach from the outcome and just let go." Remember, it was one of the things that Maslow had said to me about the characteristics or qualities of self-actualizing people, is that they detach themselves from outcome. They are no longer concerned, as it says in the Bhagavad Gita, they are no longer concerned with the fruits of their labors. You know you're on purpose. You trust in your connection to this divineness. You know you are not separate from it any longer. And so this ego part of you that is so insistent upon doing things now and doing things right and making yourself better and proving how great you are, all of that, while you don't lose it entirely, you tame it sufficiently to allow this sacred part of you. And people ask me over and over again, "Well, how do you do this? You know, how do you make it happen?" I remember reading in Vivekananda, who was another great saint who came over here to the West in the early part of this century, about 1905 or so. And someone asked him that question. He said, "In the springtime, go out and look at the blossoms on the fruit trees. This is how you do it, just like they do." He said, "The blossom vanishes of itself as the fruit grows. So too will the lower self vanish as the divine grows within you." It's not really a matter of beating anything down or conquering anything. It's allowing the divine to grow within you. And it's like thinking of yourself as a container that will only hold so much as a physical being. And if it's filled with fear and anxiety and stress and tension and all of this kind of stuff, then there's no room left in it for love and peace and detachment. If you just understand that the blossom vanishes of itself as the fruit grows, and that the lower part of you, the part of you that's ego-based, will vanish as the divine grows within you. As you practice these principles, you fill up this container with this, and it pushes that other stuff out. There's no more room for it. It just overflows and goes out. And as that happens, as you see in that metaphor, then the container that is you becomes filled with patience. And that patience is based on knowing. That knowing is based on trust. And you see how powerful this is. You've got to do this privately, without any attention on whether other people like it or don't like it. What I have found in my own life and in my own practice is that I do this in many areas of my life that are much more practical than what I've been talking about. I do it in business negotiations. I do it in the running of my professional life. What I do professionally and who I am at home and the father that I am and the husband that I am and the teacher that I am and all of this are one. And I practice these principles with my children every day. And I practice them in my relationship with my wife. And I practice them in the relationship that I have with people that I work with and who ask me to do things. I use these principles. I affirm what it is. I stay on purpose. I know what it is that I would like to see manifested. And then I retreat in peace. And I'm detached from the outcome. And you've got to be willing to detach from the outcome. And you might say to yourself, yes, but what if it doesn't work out? Which is the ego immediately asking that question. Yes, but what if it doesn't work out? You have to be willing to allow it not to work out. Because not having it work out just means it's not on your time schedule. And that means you no longer have patience. You're insisting. You're pulling on the chutes. You want that tomato now. You don't get tomatoes in May in Michigan. You got to wait till August. And if you don't like it, then send to Peru and you can have them. And so what you do is you let go of your desire to have tomatoes show up in May and you wait till June or July or August. And if you absolutely have to have tomatoes, you just go to Peru and they'll bring them to you or however that works. And you let go. And so you have this knowing and I have this knowing. And when it's not working, I don't say to myself, okay, this is proof that this program is not authentic, and this is proof that what you're talking about isn't so and so. Great things have no fear of time. When you have the knowing, you have infinite patience, you get immediate results. The immediate result is you're free. You're at peace. And that's what the whole thing is about. That's all the higher self wants, is for you to be at peace. You get to be at peace, and you got everything you need in life. Every moment in your life that you're at peace, you're enlightened. So you have a knowing, and now it doesn't show up, and the contract doesn't work out, or they say no instead of yes. But you're at peace. You say, if it's not happening now, I'm still at peace. It'll happen. I know it will. And you go back to the principles. You practice unconditional love. You don't demand. You don't insist. And then you start seeing it show up in a different way. You thought it was supposed to be over here. Got my PhD in 1970. That year, I did a job interview that was an opening that a friend of mine said, just do this job interview. It's great. It's for the vice president of a community college. And I said, all right. It was like triple what I was making at that time. But what I was doing at that time was I was teaching, and I was doing some great research projects. I was teaching at a university, which I loved being there in that environment. I had a practice, which was terrific, a counseling practice. But this idea of being the vice president, I was 30 years old, of a college, and having all of the things that go with a vice, it was just too appealing to my ego. And I went in and I did the interview. And there was a long interview process at this particular community college in Michigan. First, I had to meet with a group of students. And they all thought it was great having a, you know, a guy who's just out of his 20s be the vice president of the school. And I was cool. You know, they liked that. Then I had to be interviewed by the faculty, and the faculty all thought that I was terrific. Then I went to the administration, and the administrators weren't quite sure about whether they wanted some young upstart to be coming in there, and so you had to get 3 out of 3. Well, I got 2 out of 3. I got the faculty and the student vote, but the administration vote wasn't, and it got down to myself and another man whose last name is Cunningham, and I believe he's still in that position. And it went all the way down to the, all of these. I passed all of the different criteria, and they removed all of the other people and all of the interview process, and it was going on for months. And it came down to 2 people. And I didn't get it. And he did. And at the time that that happened, I was really kind of surprised. But there was a part of me that was relieved, because I kept thinking, I'm going to have to go to committee meetings. I'm going to have to put on a tie and a suit. And I'm going to have to go in there every day. And even though I was going to be making 3 times as much money and I was going to have all of this sort of prestige thing over here, what I really wanted to be doing over here was going to have to be put aside in the name of these ego things. And I thought what I wanted was these things that my ego was telling me. But somehow the divine intelligence knew better. And I came in second. And as a result, I went and applied for a job at a university in New York, doing what I loved doing, teaching and having my own practice. And the rest of the story is the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say. And so, when you think that it's supposed to be working and it doesn't work, and you say, yes, but it's not working, perhaps there's something else that's working, that's going on, that you may not even have any awareness about. And you have to understand that. That every fall of your life, that everything that is supposed to show up, that you think is supposed to show up and doesn't on this time, but there's perfect timing in the universe, because this divine intelligence is in all things. And it attracts to you exactly what it is supposed to at that time. Even the things that you just don't quite understand or don't seem right. I remember being in New York City and doing an interview not too long ago, and it was a radio station that had just changed formats. And they had gone from talk radio, which I had done many interviews at this station over the years, to gospel music. And so everybody that was on the staff at this radio station, some 30 people, were all told the day that I was coming there to do an interview that they had all been let go. And everybody was walking around, and they were all depressed, and they were all upset. And every time someone would come up to me and say, oh, Wayne, isn't this awful? I've been here for 22 years, and I just lost my job. And I would say, congratulations. And they'd look and say, what's the matter with you? How could you believe in congratulations? I just lost my job. And I said, yes, but within a certain amount of time, probably within a year, you'll be in a place that is much better than where you are now. And it was almost like God was trying to tell you something. But you wouldn't listen. It's time to change. It's time to walk down another street. What is your dream? And you sit down with each one of these people and you ask them, what would you really like to be doing? Rather than working here, this particular way. And then most of them said, I'd like to have my own business, or I would like to do some writing over here. I've always had some ideas about writing. One guy said that he wanted to just do an opera. He'd always wanted, and he's been working on an opera like Mr. Holland. Remember in Mr. Holland's Opus? But he could never get himself the courage to do it because he was always going into the radio station every day in New York. And then I saw him about a year and a half after that, and he was getting his opera published, which he couldn't have done if it's like this intelligence that we think is conspiring against us. It's something that we have to understand works with us. But you have to have infinite patience and trust. And when you have, and the reason it says infinite patience produces immediate results. The reason it says this is because the immediate result of your infinite patience is peace. You retreat in peace and you let the universe handle the details. And after all, that's what it's about, living your life at peace. Thank you very much. Thank you. Manifesting is called acknowledging your results with gratitude and generosity. And the affirmation for this principle is, I am deeply thankful for all that I've received, and I enjoy giving to others in the spirit of love and service. This is a very important part, not only of being able to have show up in your life what it is that is the fulfillment of your heart's desire, but it is also a beautiful way to begin living your life every day. There's an old saying that says, if you're not generous when it's hard, you will not be generous when it's easy. And generosity isn't necessarily the giving away of what you have, but it's more of a attitude of spirit, as is gratitude. So there are really three components to this eighth principle. The first is gratitude, the second is generosity, and the third is service. Let me take them one at a time here. The first is gratitude, and I remember reading a book a few years back by a friend of mine. His name is Dan Millman. I believe Dan has a program with Nightingale Conard, a wonderful speaker, and he wrote a book called The Way of the Peaceful Warrior. And in The Way of the Peaceful Warrior, he had this character who was an enlightened kind of being. And in Dan's book, The Way of the Peaceful Warrior, this character's name was Socrates. And Socrates was this fellow who worked in a gas station, but he could do all of these bizarre kinds of things. He could jump up onto a roof 14 feet in the air by just transporting himself. And he had this ability to make himself disappear and to change his shape and do many of the things that most of us, because most of us are cookie thieves, believe somehow that we can't do these things, and we know a truth. And we are attached to that truth that this is the only dimension there is, and there are no other dimensions that I can get involved in or peer into, because my senses have told me this. And we've come to put an extraordinary amount of faith in these senses, which mislead us all the time about reality. So Socrates was one of these people who was living in a different dimension, a different level of consciousness. So Socrates tells his student to go out onto a rock and sit until he can think of something important and come back and tell him something important or something significant, I believe it was. And he goes out there, the student goes out there, Dan, he's telling his own story, and he sits there on a rock, and he sits there, and every time he thinks he's got something that's really important, then he thinks about telling Socrates this, he realizes how unimportant this is. So after sitting there for a long period of time, and finally, after going to Socrates and telling him things, and Socrates says, no, that's not important. Back he would go to his rock. And he did this two or three times. No, that's not significant. And he'd go back to his rock. So finally he came and he said something, and Socrates said to him, you've got it. You have discovered something significant. And that something significant was, he said to him, there are no ordinary moments. There are no ordinary moments. And Socrates said, yes, that's significant. That is a great teaching, a great learning. And that's really the essence of gratitude. The essence of gratitude is understanding that every moment of your life is something to be grateful for, and that everything that shows up in your life is something that you will want to be expressing a sense of gratitude about. I speak often about how we take things for granted, and taking things for granted is one of the obstacles to having an attitude of gratitude. Taking things for granted very often, I mean, I've often said that I think we should have special days every year in which we appreciate all the different aspects of our being. You know, like we give thanks for our liver on Mondays, you know, on the 3rd of January, Liver Appreciation Day. You know, or just try to imagine what it would be like if you didn't have that liver. There would be nothing for you to imagine. And then, you know, for the air that we breathe, and for the ground that we walk upon, and for gravity, and for the food that we have, and for the sky, and for, you know, our eyelids, which we just take for granted. Without them, how difficult it would be for us to get through even an hour of our day. And our toenails, and everything about ourselves, to begin to experience a sense of gratitude. Now, when we're talking about affirmations, and we're talking about manifestation, here we want to look at what it is we are asking to have manifested for ourselves. And remember, we are not creating anything. We're just redistributing, if you will. Everything that needs to be created is already in the universe. There's no place to go. I remember when the story was told of Swami Muktananda, great spiritual teacher, who was dying. And all of his devotees and students gathered around, and he was leaving. And he had announced that. His students were praying with him, and they were pleading with him, please don't go, please don't go, Swami. Please, we're not ready for you to leave. And he opened his eye and looked at them and said, don't be silly. Where could I go? Where is there to go? Everything is already here. And so, when you are manifesting and you are asking for things to show up in your life, as they begin to show up in your life, learning to be grateful for those. Now, that's not so difficult. Most of us say thank you. I have a little ritual that I do every day, and that is almost every day God sends money to me in some form, particularly when I'm running. It happens virtually every day of my life. And it's a little game, a mental game that I have played with myself. I'll be out running, and I'll be thinking about all of the abundance that has shown up in my life, and how grateful I am, and how grateful I am to have my children. One of the things that my wife and I practice regularly is telling our children how fortunate we feel to be their parents, how lucky we are, not how lucky they are to have us as parents, but how blessed and how grateful we are. And I'll often pick up my little boy or one of my little girls and just put my arms around and say, you know, I am really lucky to have you. You know, I'm really blessed to have you show up in my life. I feel that way about all my children. And having that kind of attitude is something that I do with everything that has shown up in my life. Because I lived a big hunk of my life without a lot of abundance, with a great deal of scarcity. But even while I was living in scarcity, there was never a sense of poor me, or I wish I had more, or even looking at other people and saying, they've got it and I don't. That attitude keeps you from being grateful for what you have. Even as a child, I didn't learn to say, oh, they've got a Cadillac, and we have to drive around in an old Chevy or something. There was a sort of an internal knowing that you haven't earned a Cadillac. You know, that isn't something that you even think about as being yours. They used to talk about being able to buy a Cadillac when I was a young man, you know, buying my first car, and they said a Cadillac cost almost $4,000. I couldn't comprehend a Cadillac costing $4,000 and having $4,000 to buy a car. I mean, it wasn't like something I would even give a moment's notice to. If other people had that was just their karma or that was their benefits or somehow they had done something to earn that. Now, today, when I go to buy a car, $4,000 is an option. You want this stereo system instead of this one? That'll cost $4,000 extra. All right, throw it in. What do I care? It's got extra speakers. I mean, my first car was an old 1950 Plymouth that had rusted outsides on it, and I washed that thing every day, and I was so proud of it. I was so excited about that. And the idea of looking at somebody else's new car and thinking that there was something wrong here, that they had it and I didn't, couldn't have occurred to me. And I believe it's that attitude of being grateful for whatever shows up in your life that allows additional things to show up in your life. And my little ritual that I play every day when I'm out running is little coins that I find in the street. I found one this morning when I was running before I made this presentation, right out in front of the hotel. A penny, a shiny penny. And you know, I have a... I've never admitted this in public before, but I have a large jar of coins that is hidden behind, in a bookcase, behind a whole, nobody knows where this is except myself. And this contains all of the money that I have found in the last 20 years. And it's a huge amount of money. Some of it is wrinkled up bills. A lot of it is foreign money because I've run in foreign countries. And most of the coins are dirty and they've been out in the street for a long time. And there's a couple of $20 bills. There's a $100 bill in there. And every time I look at that little symbol that just keeps growing, it reminds me to be grateful. And when I pick up one of those coins, I always say, thank you, God, for this symbol of abundance that has shown up in my life. Thank you. And I put it in my pocket, and I put it away in a special. And then when I get back to my office, I go to that little place, and I put it in there, and I look at that, and that's my reminder. What gratitude does is it keeps you connected to that source which brings things into your life. It keeps that connection open because gratitude comes from love. See, there's two ways to look at things in your life. There's to appreciate what shows up in your life or to depreciate what shows up in your life. And to depreciate it means to complain about it, to whine about it, to resent it because it's not big enough, it's not shiny enough, it's not what I wanted. That's a depreciation. And appreciation, to appreciate, means to have a sense of being grateful for it. Gratitude, there's a wonderful definition that I use for gratitude. Gratitude is the complete and full response of the heart to everything in the universe. The complete and full response of the heart to everything in the universe. And this gratitude disallows feelings of separateness from what shows up. See, resentment or complaining or fault-finding are things that block you, are obstacles to that free flow. They reinforce the idea that I am separate from that and it's not giving me enough. Gratitude for what shows up and expressing that gratitude with affirmations and regular affirmations of it is a way of keeping that channel clear between you and that divine presence. And doing this little ritual that I do with the coins, I also do it when I'm driving. And someone lets me in into a lane when I'm trying to change lanes. There's this very quick and silent little thank you for that loving gesture. It doesn't seem like much. It's not like this big deal. I don't tell anybody about it. I happen to be talking about it now because it's just the focus of this particular principle. But it's not anything that I share with anybody else. It's a very private little thing that I do. When someone lets me into a parking space, a thank you, an acknowledgement. You know, when I'm in a grocery store and I go out to the car and I take the cart out to the parking lot and I put my groceries in the trunk, I always take the thing and I take it back. It doesn't seem like this is my own little private little thing. It's like I'm grateful for this food. When we go into a restaurant and we sit down and eat and there's a sign there that says generally thank you for taking your tray and putting it back and for... My children have all learned that when we finish up where we're eating, we are thankful for the food, and we're also thankful for the place that we have to eat, and we want to leave it the way it was when we got here. We're grateful for the cleanliness. We're grateful for the air. There's this kind of attitude. I remember being with Wally Amos, famous Amos, in Hawaii, who also has a program with Nightingale Connor. Everybody seems to. And the first time I'd ever met him, we were walking in a street in Maui, and he saw a beer can there, and he said, "Excuse me," and he walked all the way over there, and he picked up the beer can, and he put it into the trash can. And he didn't say a word to me, and I didn't say a word to him, but I noticed that. I noticed there was a sense of gratitude for the islands. It's called an aloha kind of spirit, a sense of feeling grateful and expressing it in everything that you do in your life. And this kind of an attitude begins to become infectious. And it also opens the channel for more to show up. People who are grateful seem to get more than people who are resentful. You know why? Because people who are resentful don't understand that their resentment itself is what's blocking. And when they do get something, their instantaneous response to it is, it's not enough. It's not big enough. Somebody else got something that's better. I should have had this. I wanted it yesterday. I showed up too late. It's not the right color. It's not the right size. You know, the endless not feeling of gratitude. There's a wonderful little old joke about a lady who was on the beach with her grandson. And she's walking along the beach. And all of a sudden this huge wave comes along and picks up the little boy. And he disappears. And she just goes down on her knees and she just doesn't know what to do. This is my grandson. Please, God, send my grandson back. I can't stay. What has happened? How could this have happened? Oh, please, I'll do anything. I'll do anything. And all of a sudden another wave comes along and plops him right back down right in front of her. And she looks at him and she turns around and she goes on her knees. She says to God, he was wearing a hat. You know. I haven't thought of that story in a long time. This idea is not just good citizenship we're talking about here. It's cultivating this attitude of flow, of allowing, of permitting things to continue to grow in you, because gratitude is love. Now, the hardest part about gratitude for most people is the understanding that you have to also be grateful when things don't show up. And you have to learn, this is the toughest part, you have to learn to be grateful for that which you don't have and for the suffering that you are going through and for the experiences of scarcity that seem to be present in your life. Because in essence, until you can be grateful in these moments and understand that you can't have sobriety, generally speaking, without having known its opposite. Everything in the physical plane has its opposite. People who have been through addictions generally know and appreciate and are grateful for those addictions when they transcend them. You won't find very many alcoholics who are in recovery who will say, "I resent my addiction days." Instead, what they say is, "They were the greatest teachers I ever had. And I couldn't be where I am today without having had those." Now, this is true for all of our experiences. When people say to me, can you really say that you are grateful that your father walked out of your life when you were just a baby? Can you really say that the time that he spent in prison and the time, the fact that he never sent any money, and the fact that you had to spend early years in foster homes and so on, and away from the rest of your family, can you really say that you're grateful for that? I say, my father was my greatest teacher. I never met the man. But without my experience of learning to rely upon myself as a young boy, I couldn't, as a grown man, be teaching self-reliance today. Couldn't do it. Because to learn to rely upon yourself is something that you have to have the direct conscious experience of. And when you've had it, then you can teach it. And I'm grateful for it. I was having dinner last night with my oldest daughter, Tracy, and I was thinking about her mother and I who have been divorced for 20, 25 years now. And I was telling Tracy at dinner that your mother, even though we didn't agree and didn't get along, your mother was one of the great people in my life. There are many qualities that both of us could look at in her, and she could look at in me, certainly, and say, these are the reasons why it didn't work. But you can also do the opposite. You can look at this person and say, but look at these qualities. Look at the honesty. Look at the integrity. Look at these things and remember that. And my experience being married to my daughter's mother, to Judy, those many years ago, when I was a young boy, it seems like, taught me how to be not only a better husband later on and a better father, but it gave me direct experiences of being able to transcend my own pettiness and my own inability to relate at a level that I am able to do today. Without that, I couldn't be where I am today. I've often said to people, I am what is called a reverse paranoid. You know, when you ask someone, what is a paranoid? Well, a paranoid thinks that everybody is talking about you and that they're saying terrible things about you. And a reverse paranoid is someone who knows that everybody's talking about you, but they're saying nice things about you. So when you walk by and someone says, are they talking about me? You say, yeah, of course. Why wouldn't they be? And this attitude of being able to be grateful, not just for the things that are manifesting and showing up in your life, but for the things that don't show up and for those experiences, when you get to a point where in this moment I can now say, okay, it didn't show up and there's a great lesson in this and I'll get that lesson and then I'll stop the blockage of abundance flowing into my life. That's what gratitude is. It is the free expression of the heart to the fullness of the universe. And an understanding that you're not going to get it all, that you are it all already. You are it all already. That divine, organizing, omniscient, all-loving, unconditional loving God is in you already. And everything that you need to be peaceful, to have love, to be successful, you already have in this moment. You don't need one thing more. Anything else that shows up is just a bonus from the universe. And you got to be grateful for all of it, including that which doesn't. In order to be able to move to the next level, generally speaking, you first experience a fall. In order to be able to move to the next level, spiritual advancements are usually preceded by a fall of one kind or another. And in order to generate the energy to get to a higher place, you must first experience a fall. It's like when I was a high jumper on the track team, I would run up to the bar and I would get down as low as I could get. And then I would, by the process of getting down low, I could propel myself to a higher level. That's the metaphor. And you have to be grateful for those falls. The second aspect of this principle is one of generosity. Generosity is taking all that manifests for you in your life, all that shows up for you, and being willing to share it. The thing that generosity does for us is that it liberates us from the concept of scarcity. And that's what we need to have in order to be manifestors. You become liberated from the idea of scarcity when you are willing to generously give of that which shows up in your life. There are many people who tithe. Well, that is, they give a percentage, generally 10% of their earnings, to those who provide spiritual nourishment or spiritual food in their life. Even when they don't have it. I did a benefit just recently on Maui for a man who, when he was 32 or 33 years old, his name is Michael Leboff, he was a strapping, surfing-type dude on Maui, just a cool guy who was waiting tables and good-looking and had women coming here and there all the time and just like one of these guys, you know, that you see all over Maui. He was at the beach one day, and they were playing frisbee out there, and someone threw the frisbee, and he said, "I'll get it for you." And he went and he dove into the shallow water to get the frisbee. But at the moment that he dove, the wave somehow it receded at that exact second, and the wave was gone, and he hit the sand. Now this was an experienced surfer, and he broke the broke his neck, and he became a quadriplegic in that instant. And then he said, at that moment, he said, "I was reborn." That was about 3 years earlier from now. And this summer, when I was on Maui, a friend of his, Frank Levinson, called me and asked me if I would be willing to do a benefit, if I would speak, and if Jerry Jampolsky, who has also done a program with Manuel Kant called Love is Letting Go of Fear, and Jerry and I both did a benefit. I spoke for an hour and a half. Jerry spoke for an hour and a half. And people came in and donated money, and he needed $10,000 in order to go to the Miami Project for the treatment of spinal cord injuries. And now they're finding that there are ways to not only assist these people in their life, but perhaps to even get them walking again. And so they're going to do a complete evaluation, but he needed $10,000. So we did this benefit. And they raised $9,000, and I threw in $1,000, and he had his $10,000. But the interesting thing about this was that when it was done, he took the $1,000 that I gave him, which represented 10% of what he had earned. This man in a wheelchair who is paralyzed from the shoulders down, and he sent it to Kay O'Bara, the woman whose daughter has been in a coma for 27 years, because he felt that he had to give something back. That kind of generosity will allow Michael not only to have the Miami Project show up, where he will be in November, but it will allow probably the healing that he is looking for to begin to take hold, because it releases him from this idea that there is scarcity out there. If you're free enough to give what you have away, especially the things that you have that you treasure, like a lot of people say, and I've been practicing this for quite a few years now, a lot of people say, well, you go through your clothes that you haven't worn in the last year or two, and if you haven't worn them, just take them out of the closet and give them to someone who can benefit from them. You can always find someone that will benefit from them, which is a wonderful thing to do. But a more powerful, spiritually enriching thing to do is to go through the clothes that you like the best and that you wear all the time, or that you wouldn't want to part with because they really mean so much to you, and give 10% of those away. Then you'll see the spiritual food, if you will, beginning to show up more and more into your life. When you can give away something of yourself that you seem to be attached to, because detaching from it is a big part of this business of manifesting. You see, when you become generous, you are really saying to the universe and to yourself very quietly, I know there are no limits to this divine intelligence. I know it's inexhaustible. I know it was never born. I know it can never die. And therefore, I am willing to allow it to flow through me. The divine intelligence is always moving. It is always flowing. Generosity takes you away from that idea that somehow there's a scarcity out there. I remember I was in New Orleans not too long ago, and I was giving a talk, and I went for a walk with my assistant and several other people, several friends who had come there to hear me speak. And we were walking in the seedy section of New Orleans, where there's a lot of drug addicts, a lot of street people, a lot of prostitutes, a lot of poverty, a lot of lost souls, people who believe that they're alone. And whenever I'm in one of those places, and I seem to be attracted to those places, I think about there but for the grace of God, so many of us know, go. So many people, when they see homeless people, they think about, well, I'd really like to give to them, but they're really just lazy. And they should go out and get a job. And that keeps me from being generous to them. And I would say to you that if you can't give with love, don't give. Just give a silent blessing. But don't send anger and hatred and judgment and bitterness towards those who are out there, whatever it is that they're doing. I wouldn't say give despite it. If you don't feel it coming from your heart, if it's not a heart-based thing, then it is artificial and you will just be filled with resentment and you'll stop the blockage of this flow of energy. So give a silent blessing to that person and hope that perhaps they can find another way or a higher way. But there's also the element of how often that kind of an attitude is what we use to keep us from being able to part with something that we are so attached to. And it's a very convenient thing to hang on to. And we often forget. And being in New Orleans, and there was a young girl, she couldn't have been more than 15. She had been on the streets for 4 years. She hadn't had a bath, I don't think, in all that time. She was obviously into drugs and smelled bad. And I saw the spirit in that child. And I started talking to her. And she was giving me the talk that you hear from street people about all the reasons why she was there and blaming her mother and blaming all of these kinds of, and essentially not taking responsibility for what her life was. She was kind of, she started to cry after a little while, and I mean, she was really a little girl. And my heart tugged so strong at her, and I offered, I said, you know, my assistant, Maya, was there, and I said, you know, Maya could take you over to the hotel. We can get you a room there. We'll get you all cleaned up. Well, and she just didn't want any part of that at all. So before we left, I said, come over here, Carolyn. And I reached into my pocket, and I had a $100 bill in my pocket, and I gave her the $100 bill. And the people that were there with me said, as we were walking away, don't you realize that you just enabled her to have more drugs and that she's going to spend that on alcohol and on... And I said, you know, it doesn't matter to me what she does with the money. That's not why I gave it to her. I said, the money, as far as I'm concerned, represents one act of kindness from one human being to another. That's all it is. I'm detached from the outcome. I'm not concerned about where that will go. But maybe this person just needs to have one person put their arm around her, demonstrate a little caring, and maybe that one act will help her to get her life off of the streets and off of that death sentence that she was living out. Perhaps. And as you practice generosity of spirit, detach from the outcome about what people are going to do with it, where it's going to go, how it's going to get used, whether it's going to be done for the right way or the way I think it should be done. Detach from that and give from your heart all that shows up in your life. Just let it keep flowing. And after a while, what happens is you are completely detached from how it works out. And you're not even attached to how things show up in your life. And all of those things that you used to be so concerned with when you were back there as an athlete and a warrior and asking for so much and being so concerned of whether you're going to get it and how it's going to show up, when you reach this level of generosity and gratitude in your life, what happens is miraculous. It no longer matters. And the irony here is that as it no longer matters to you, more and more shows up. Until it gets to a point where you can't even handle it all. And you just keep letting it circulate. And you're not concerned at all with where the next one is going to be. You have a knowing. You are so aware of the abundance and the unlimitedness of the divine intelligence that is in everything, that it can't be exhausted, that you're willing to allow it to continue to flow through your life. And then you get in synchronicity with that divine force. It's almost like you have a collaboration with fate. And as you collaborate rather than fight, scarcity moves away in your life. That's how I give. When I give, I ask not for one explanation of how it's going to be used. The giving is done for the purpose of being generous, of the opening of the heart chakra to another human being. And the final aspect of this eighth principle is one that is called service. And very simply, it is shifting the emphasis of your life off of what are my quotas and what's in it for me onto how may I serve you. I have had to practice this in my own life, and it has worked in ways that I can't even begin to tell you. When I go before an audience and I sit down to meditate, I repeat the mantra, how may I serve, how may I serve, how may I serve. How can I get my ego out of this presentation, out of this program, out of what it is that I am doing, and my needs to have rewards and have money come into me, and my needs to have applause and to have people tell me how wonderful I am. How can I get all of that out? And it doesn't matter what you do. You can shift to gratitude, generosity, and service. If you're a dentist, you can give a flower to every patient. You can call them in the evening and ask how they're doing, as my dentist always does. You can make your waiting room a place where people look forward to coming by putting in programs like this for people to listen to while they're being drilled on. It doesn't make any difference. If you're a cab driver, you can make your cab a place of service. You can do a little bit extra. And the irony is, when you turn your life over to being a statesman and ultimately to being a spiritual being, this attitude allows this free-flowing, unconditional, loving energy that is the divine universe, that is God, to enter into your life. And it just keeps flowing. You're just keeping the channels open, folks. That's all you're doing. You're just keeping it open. And you're aware of every little cue that comes along that blocks that channel. The minute that it's there, it's an angry thought, it's a judgmental thought, it's a stressful thought. The minute that it shows up, you replace it with an attitude of service, gratitude, generosity, and it leaves. I'd like to close this principle with another reading of a wonderful poet whose name is Khalil Gibran, the Lebanese poet who wrote a great collection of writings called The Prophet back in 1923. Which is still a bestseller today and deserves it. And he wrote on many different subjects, great wisdom. And here, I'd like to share with you what he wrote on self-knowledge. And think about this business of gratitude and generosity and service. And a man said, "Speak to us on self-knowledge." And he answered, saying, "Your hearts know in silence the secrets of the days and nights. But your ears thirst for the sound of your heart's knowledge. You would know in words that which you would have always known in thought. You would touch with your fingers the naked body of your dreams. And it is well you should. The hidden wellspring of your soul must needs rise and run murmuring to the sea. And the treasure of your infinite depths would be revealed to your eyes. But let there be no scales to weigh your unknown treasure. And seek not the depths of your knowledge with staff or sounding line, for self is a sea, boundless and measureless. Say not, I have found the truth, but rather, I have found a truth. Say not, I have found the path of the soul. Say rather, I have met the soul walking upon my path. For the soul walks upon all paths. The soul walks not upon a line, neither does it grow like a reed. The soul unfolds itself like a lotus of countless petals." Beautiful.
beautiful. Your hearts know in silent
the secrets of the days and nights. The part of you that knows, the part of you that is infinite, as the poet suggests, the part of you that is every place, is also in all that you would like to see show up in your life. And if you keep a generous, grateful, serving attitude, you'll never block it. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.